1893. This is an interview with Sonia Pressman Fuentes. My name is Dennis Deslup, and we are interviewing Ms. Fuentes in Potomac, Maryland. And this is an oral history discussing her experiences in government work and her encounters with labor organizations and other things of interest in terms of politics in the 1960s and 70s. I thought we'd start by just asking you, and I know you've done some of this just glancing at this other interview, but if you could just let us know your background, if you could, date of birth, family background, and then we could talk perhaps about political or cultural influences or educational influences in your early life. But if you just sort of get started, I could jump in and narrow down on the questions.
Okay, I'll get started and you cut back if I'm getting too lengthy or whatever. I was born in Berlin, Germany on May 30th, 1928. My parents were Jewish. I had a brother 14 years older than I. My parents had lived 23 years in Berlin and were both Polish originally. We left Germany in 1933 because of the Nazis. Went initially to Belgium for a number of months and then came on to the United States.
So how old were you then when, by the time you got to the States?
We got to the States May 1st, 1934, and I was 6 years old the end of that month.
Okay. Where did you settle in the States?
We originally lived in the Bronx for a short period of time. Oh, maybe a year or a year and a half, I'm not sure. And in 1936, we moved to the Catskill Mountains of New York, to a small town called Woodridge, New York, and then moved to a larger town called Monticello, New York, and I graduated as valedictorian of Monticello High School.
Okay. And then you went on to college?
No.
Okay.
I worked for, there was a 4-year interval, during part of which time I worked in New York, and part of which time I vacationed in Florida. I'm sorry, then I went to college. I was thinking of between college and law school.
Oh, okay.
That's right, then I went to college. I went to Cornell between 1946 and 1950. And then there was a 4-year interval when I worked some in New York and vacationed in Florida, and then I went to law school.
If I could, with some of this, I'd back up and move forward.
Fine.
In terms of your early life and the political and governmental work you did later, did you find anything that influenced you in your early life, whether in your family in terms of politics or life experiences that proved important later?
Okay. Yes. There were several influences in my early life. First of all, my parents were well-to-do people in Germany. And my mother tells me that it was not fashionable to have a lot of children among the well-to-do. So before I was born, she had had 7 abortions and went to have an abortion with me, but the doctor was out. And rather than going to another doctor, my parents decided to have me. I tell that story usually as a humorous story, and I can make it a humorous story, and it is a humorous story to me. I haven't done that now for lack of time. So that was the first influence on me, that I almost wasn't born. That was the first of a number of influences. I'll tell you the others that made me think as a child that there was something I was to do in the world, something I was to contribute to the world, and that I could not just lead a normal life for my own pleasure as other people did. Second influence, that we left Germany at an early time and escaped the Holocaust. So that was the second time I was saved. Again, reinforcing the idea that, and this is not unusual for Holocaust survivors, I wasn't really a Holocaust survivor, but for people who escaped, it's not unusual to feel the burden of having to justify your existence. That was the second influence on my life. Third was that I grew up in as an outsider in many ways. I was a Jew, which made me sensitive to civil rights. I was not born in the United States. My parents were immigrants, and a little bit older. My mother was 38 when I was born. My parents moved around some, from the Bronx to Woodridge to Monticello, then they'd go to Florida, then they went to Long Beach, Long Island. And so I was always like the new kid on the block. Again made me an outsider. I was bright, that made me, to some extent, an outsider. And finally, when I was 8 years old, I started to have to wear glasses. Mm-hmm. And that detracted from being attractive. We also lived out of town, and I didn't have any social graces or any social skills. Wasn't too much to look at. So all of these things made me an outsider. On top of that, my parents used to drive to Florida for many winters, mm-hmm. To vacation there, and also I had asthma as a child briefly, and supposedly it was going to be better down there than in a winter climate. And so I was very conscious of the discrimination against African Americans that I saw traveling through the South. The benches were marked black and white, the fountains were black and white, the restrooms were black and white, the buses, African Americans had to sit in the back, the newspapers were full of vitriolic, racist statements. So I became interested in the civil rights movement.
Was your family apolitical, or
yes.
Now I'm talking partisan-wise?
Apolitical, okay. Totally. How did you know to ask that question?
Well, sometimes it's been an influence, and sometimes not. It depends on the case, and it's not. There's no general rule, but and some people sometimes are very conservative, and they end up being very liberal. So it works out. It works out different ways.
My parents had only one interest in life. Mm-hmm. A very sort of a narrow tunnel vision type of interest, and that was to make a living for the family. There was really nothing else that interested them.
But you went to Cornell, and this was at a period when women didn't always go to college. Was there a sense that that was encouraged, or?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
I went to college on a fluke. First of all, I had never seen a college in my life, except in the Andy Hardy movies. No one in my family had ever gone to college. My father did not know how to read or write in any language, except he learned to read the Yiddish paper. My mother could read and write, and she knew Polish and English and Yiddish, but my father not. That is not to take away from the fact that he was one of the smartest men I knew and always made an excellent living for his family, but mm-hmm. he didn't know how to read and write. I started out in high school in a secretarial course to learn shorthand typing to be a secretary. That's what women did then. I was friendly with a teacher there who used to pick me up. I lived out of town, and she lived further out. She used to pick me up. Her name was Miss Gallagher, and drive me to school. And so she said to me, "I must leave that secretarial course because it's for not the brightest students in the class, and I didn't belong there." So I said, okay, but I was enjoying the course.
Mm-hmm.
So she put me into a college entrance or some other type of course that wasn't secretarial, but I still did not plan that.
Okay.
I'm interested that you're going into all this detail.
Oh, well, it's amazing how it really makes an influence. I just didn't want to start it on the 1960s, okay. But we dropped the microphone for a second, and it's okay, and I
all
think
right.
It works fine now. Yes, you can go ahead. I'm sorry.
So I went to the ladies' room one day, and a classmate of mine named Joan Rulin. Also, I was conscious of the fact that because I came from Germany and started school a little later, I was going to be 22 when I graduated from high school.
Okay.
Now, today, that seems to be normal, but in those years, most people graduated at 21. So I felt that I was going to be old when I graduated from high school.
High school, you mean college?
No, high school.
High school. Okay.
Oh, no, that's right. High school, I was going to be 18,
right.
College, 22.
Okay.
But I wasn't thinking about college, but 18 out of high school, and the other kids that I knew were going to be 17.
Okay.
So this Joan Rulin saw me in the ladies' room, and she said, "What are you going to do when you get out of high school?" I says, "What do you mean? What am I going to do? I'm graduating from high school." She says, "You're not going to go to college?" I said, "No, I never thought about it. I'd be too old if I went to college because I'd graduate at 22. She said, well, I'm going to college. So I started to think about that. Meanwhile, she went to college 1 year, came back to Monticello, married a classmate, and never left town again.
Okay.
Now, she'd been very successful in business and everything, but she never went to college.
Okay.
But I started to think about it. So I applied to two colleges. One was Hartwick College in Oneonta, New York. And the other was Cornell. I don't know. I heard of those two. I applied to those two. I didn't apply to more. I didn't know what you were supposed to do. I didn't have any guidance. I didn't have any counseling. There was nothing like that there. My parents couldn't help me. What did they know about college? So after I applied to those two colleges, and this guy in my class, Jake Nemerson, said to me that he was going to Middletown, New York to take an exam for a scholarship. And he asked me if I wanted to go along. And the exam cost either $4.50 or $7.50. But if you won the scholarship, you got like, I don't know, $750 or some kind of an amount like that. So I said to him, I don't know. I have to ask my father. So I went to my father and I asked him whether I should go take this scholarship exam that it was going to cost $4.50. But if you got the scholarship, you got $750. So my father said, certainly, you pay $450 and you get $750. He didn't understand that not everybody won the scholarship.
I see.
So I went with Jake Nemerson, and I won that scholarship. And when I went back and told my father about it, he wasn't surprised because that's how he understood the deal in the first place. And I believe that scholarship is what got me into Cornell.
I see.
Because I think in those days, Cornell was really only taking people who had some kind of a scholarship.
Okay.
And so I wrote to Hartwick and I said, I'm sorry, I've been accepted at Cornell. And that's how I came to go to Cornell.
Did Cornell, was it a political campus? This would be the early 50s.
This was 1946 to 1950.
Okay, and was it was it a political campus? I know they had a industrial relations school there.
Yeah.
Did any of that make an impact on you at that point in your life?
No. First of all, I don't think it was all that political. But Cornell made a tremendous impact on my life, but in a different way. You got to remember that here I was, an 18-year-old girl with glasses. I had braces on my teeth at that point. The first time away from home. When I came to Cornell, I asked people where was Cornell because I was looking for a single building. And people told me, this is Cornell. I said, where is the building? And they said, this whole area is Cornell, all these buildings. I mean, that's what I knew, okay? So I was totally, the first 3 or 6 months, you know, dazed by the whole thing. Very impressed with all the other students and in their social savoir-faire, of which I had none. So the biggest initial impact on me was that I had been raised in a Jewish home and my parents' friends were mostly Jewish. So the impact there was that for the first time in my life, I was in close contact with non-Jewish people. And I liked them.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw they were, you know, people like anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first impact was that for 18 years, I'd been kept away. I mean, not consciously kept away, but from the style of life my parents lived. I'd been kept away from 95% of the world, the non-Jewish world. And I rebelled against that. And for a while, I didn't want to be Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
And I determined never again to live in a world like that. And I never have. So that was the first big impact. And beyond that, I made a circle of friends. I really was not active at Cornell in organizations because I was too busy just learning how to live in such an environment. And I was busy changing majors, because I didn't know what I wanted to do. So I was constantly changing majors. And that's what I did.
And then you, so you went to Cornell, and then you actually, between Cornell and law school, you worked for 4 years, you said?
Well, they were 4 years, during about 2.5 of which I was working. The rest of the time I was vacationing.
Okay. And then you went to law school?
University of Miami, Florida.
Okay. Something happened at that point. I mean, what pushed you to go to law school?
A number of things, again.
Okay.
My parents, had a bungalow colony in Monticello, New York, but they also invested in mortgages.
Okay.
And there was a husband and wife team in Ellenville, New York, a nearby town, that they used as attorneys. So I had seen a woman lawyer. You know, I had contact with a woman lawyer. It was, at that time, it wasn't a big deal to me, you know, but it was something that I had exposure to. Secondly, because my parents were immigrants and their English wasn't, you know, I mean, it was certainly adequate, but wasn't that great, and mine exceeded theirs in no time. So from the time I was about 10 years old, I did the paperwork in my family.
I see.
And correspondence, contracts, we rented out bungalows, I drafted the contracts, I wrote the letters, and it was the kind of household, I'm not sure what the reason was, but I was in it with my parents. I wasn't a child. Unfortunately, I didn't have much of a childhood. I was with them in business. So that was the second influence. Then at one point I was in a great books group and I read, I think it was, I don't remember him now, I knew for many years, I don't think it was Thomas Aquinas, it was some guy who wrote on law.
Okay.
And that influenced me. And then I thought when I got out of college that the world was going to beat a path to my door because I was Phi Beta Kappa. And all this and that, and it took me 7 months to find a job. I had to go to secretarial school and study shorthand, and I was getting no place fast. I was a secretary, and I was getting no place fast.
Oh, before I forget, with your bachelor's at Cornell, what was that in?
I had a bachelor, a liberal arts degree, but I had a year in the Graduate School of Business and Public Administration.
Okay.
Because I never knew what I wanted to do. I majored in psychology, I majored in languages, I got a BA, but I also had a year of public and business administration.
I see, okay, just wanted to comment.
But that was my senior year, it wasn't an extra year.
Okay.
So I saw that I was getting no place fast in my career, which wasn't a career, I was a secretary. And then I was working for Cone Hall Marks as a secretary, and the guy that I was working for was shit.
Okay.
And a very unfriendly guy, and they called me in and said I was constantly being transferred, and I said, no, you're not going to transfer me again. I quit, and I'm going to law school.
Okay.
And that, I really just wanted to shock them, because the women didn't go to law school in those days. But I made that statement, and then at the last moment I decided to give a birthday party for myself, and my birthday is Memorial Day. So when I decided to give the birthday party, everybody else had other plans, and they couldn't come. So I said, well, I can't rely on my friends for my life. I better go have a career. And so all of these things, and plus I was down in, another factor was that we were always down in Miami for the winters.
Okay.
And one time I drove by the law school, and it was a very pretty campus. And I always loved college campuses. So whenever I go to see a campus, I want to register. And I couldn't register because I was already a college graduate. But I figured, well, but I can go to law school. So I went in and I took the LSAT, whatever it was called.
Yeah.
And I came out the 98th, the 99th, whatever. So all these threads wove together.
Okay. And in law school, there wasn't, there's still, you weren't politically active there either.
I was vice president of the law school.
Oh, okay.
But I wasn't politically active. And I was, I went on behalf of the law school to this Law Students Association conference in New Orleans, and I came away with the University of Miami being the site for the next one, the following year, and I was responsible for that. But I wasn't politically active as you mean, no.
Yeah. And were there any law school courses, or did you get interested in government law or contract?
No.
I mean, it took a little bit of everything?
Yeah.
Okay.
My idea in going to law school was to go into private practice. I had no interest in working for the government. We used to drive through Washington on the way to Florida, and it looked to me like a gray, anonymous city. And I've always had a need to be recognized. And I didn't see how I could be recognized in this city with all these people working in these buildings. So my only interest was to have a private practice like this husband and wife team I've mentioned. Their names were Ethel and Joe Cooperman.
Oh, okay.
And I wanted to have a practice like they did. I wanted to get married and practice law with my husband.
And so what happened? You got out of law school in the, I'm trying to bring it up to date now.
57.
Okay. And?
Another fluke. One summer, I worked in Miami Beach for $10 a week as a law clerk for a law firm. And it was two partners, and one partner was a nice guy, and the other one really wasn't. And I was a little bit disillusioned by this other partner. But then the real thing was that at my law school, there was a woman professor named Minette Massey. She's still there, and I'm still in touch with her. I never took a course with her. She was the law school librarian. And somewhere towards the end of my last year in law school, she called me up at home and said, "Sonia, did you see a notice on the bulletin board that someone is coming down from the Department of Labor to interview students?" And I said, "Yes, I saw it, but I have no interest in going to work in Washington." So she said, I think that you should go to that interview, and I made an appointment for you."
How about that?
So I went. Mm-hmm. And subsequently, I was offered a job by this woman, Bessie Margolin, and subsequently became a friend of mine, for the Department of Labor. So after that, the Justice Department came down to the law school. And because I had gone to the first one that Minette Massey arranged for me, I went to the second one. And they offered me a job in what was then called the Attorney General's Program for Honor Law Graduates, which was a highfalutin name for absolutely nothing. It was just a way to get you into the Justice Department. And they also offered me a job. So then I turned down the Labor Department job, and I took the job with them.
So your first job out of law school was justice.
Yes.
Came up and lived in Washington?
Yeah.
Okay. And what was, and because actually I have to confess, I don't know I know that you work with the EEOC, but I don't know, so you were with the Department of Justice?
Well, the Department of Justice had different sections.
Okay.
And I opted for an office no longer in existence called the Office of Alien Property.
Okay.
Which, the reason I opted for it was because of my European background. They dealt with claims for the return of property seized by the United States under the Trading with the Enemy Act and other acts.
Oh, okay.
During the First World War, if enemy aliens had property in the United States, the United States took it.
Yep.
And there were also other situations where the United States took property. The big case involved I.G. Farben. And then there were certain provisions under which certain people could get their property back, like Jews could get their property back, or you could get your property back if you said, "I wasn't really a German, I was a Swede," or who knows what. And so the Office of Alien Property processed claims for the return of property. Excuse me.
We're going to stop for just one second.
Good.
Okay.
Friend of mine had
That is a good idea.
Yeah.
No, we just had to stop for a minute to take care of phones, and we may have to do that again, but that's okay. I was asking, you were telling me about your first job at Justice, and you worked in the Department of Alien Property.
Right, Office of Alien
Property. Office of Alien Property. Okay, that's right, yeah. So, I don't know if I caught you were mid-sentence or not, but one of the questions I was going to ask is, two things. What you were telling me what you did in the office, but also how many women worked in this office? Was it considered a friendly place for women to work in the 50s? And
didn't come up.
In the federal?
It didn't really come up. There were other women working there.
Okay. Was there a sense of being segregated? The women
it was
a fairly friendly place to work.
No, it was a small office. And also, as long as you're asking me that, I did not encounter any discrimination at the law school except for the following. The first few weeks that I was there, and there were other women in the law school with me, but not, there were a good, I would say between 5 and 10 other women were in the law school. I don't know, the total population is small, it's not a big law school. The first 6 weeks when I was there, there were about 6 boys, not boys, young men, who used to tease me.
Okay.
I don't remember how they did it. It was nothing horrendous, but they would tease me so. And the ringleader was a guy, as I recall, his name was Larry Perlmutter. And this went on for 6 weeks, and then I went over to him. And I said, why are you doing this to me?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "Oh, I didn't know it really bothered you." And that was it. I never had another problem. I was not discriminated against by the professors or the teachers or nothing. I graduated first in the law school. I was vice president of the law school. I did have a problem in law school. But I did in Washington when I tried to get employment out of the government.
You did not at Justice, but at other...
Outside of the government to try to get employment.
I see.
And the government too, but I didn't hit it then because I was too low.
Okay. So the first job was at Justice. This is in the mid to late 50s.
This is in 1957 to 59.
Okay. How long did you stay in this job?
A year and a half.
Okay. And then what?
They decided they were going to eliminate that agency.
Okay.
And make it a part of Justice. make it not a separate office.
Okay.
It was going to remain as some little something part of Justice. So I need to find another job.
Okay.
So initially, the Justice Department people came and guaranteed all of us who were on this honor program mm-hmm. that they would place all of us. And that was worth zero. Maybe they placed one or two people. Basically, they weren't able to do that. So I had to find a job. And a guy that I knew at the Office of Alien Property, his name was Paul Elkin, he had gotten a job at the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board. So I called him up, and I asked him, I said, you've just been through job hunting. What can you tell me? I need to find a job because this agency is closing. Mm-hmm. So he said, why don't you come over here? So he set me up for an interview with a guy named Lou Schwartz. And Lou asked me some of the questions that you asked me about what I studied in law school. I went to him for the interview, and he said, you're looking for a job here in labor law. He said, are you interested in that subject? I said, no. He said, did you study it in law school? I said, no. He said, if you get hired here, you plan to take courses in it? I said, no. He said, why are you here? Sorry.
Okay, no, that's okay. We're going to stop for a minute again. So you're interviewing for the NLRB, and you really don't have any previous experience with unions or any, at least in the interview, you don't have any intense interest.
No, I didn't.
Okay.
So he asked me all those questions. I answered no to everything. And he said, why are you here? And I said, I need a job. And he said, you're hired. So that was the beginning of basically my entire career, which was in labor law or in something related to labor law.
Did you get to like it right away? Or what happened?
No, I didn't. It's always hard for me at the beginning of something, and I feel I can't handle it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was really overwhelmed. And I either wrote to my father, and I wrote to my father, you'll say, how could you write to your father? Well, I'd write to my parents, my mother
right.
would read the letter. I either wrote to my father when I spoke to him, and I said, I'm, you know, having troubles here, I don't understand this whole thing. And my father said, like everybody else in that building is managing, so you'll manage. And so I did. I never really understood, I had a lot of different jobs at the labor board. I was always looking for a better job, and every job I ever had, I was always looking for a better job. And so in the labor board, I tried to prepare myself for a better job by getting as much experience in different sections as I could. So I started out working for this guy, Lou Schwartz, in a section called Advice in the general counsel side.
Okay.
And then I worked for a guy named Curly Summers in another position. And then I got about 2-3 months experience in the Pittsburgh field office. And then I worked about 1.5 years in the LA field office. And then I worked for the chairman of the board, Boyd Leadham. And then I worked for a wonderful board member, I think his name, Jerry Brown.
Okay.
So I was altogether in the labor board from 59 to 65.
Had you begun to form an opinion about unions at this time? I mean,
yeah, I tended to be, well, I'll tell you something. I was a freak at the labor board.
Mm-hmm.
Because I felt myself in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
Most people there were either pro-union or pro-management. Mm-hmm. I had strains of both in my nature. My father was a businessman.
Right.
So I related to management mm-hmm. through my father's always having been in business. And my brother became a businessman. But really, because my father was a businessman and I was in business with my parents. On the other hand, through my civil rights personal sensitivity, I was sympathetic to what the unions were trying to do. I was really in the middle.
Yeah. Did you pursue labor as being, did you work on specific cases where you would encounter labor officers or?
When I worked in Pittsburgh and Los Angeles, I did.
And did you form an opinion in terms of which ones were more progressive or which ones were less so at this time?
No. I was basically just investigating the case or writing up the case from the legal point of view. I felt like I was in the middle. I supported the idea of collective bargaining, I didn't really find myself until I went to the EOC.
Okay.
And so labor law itself did not really resonate all that strongly with me.
So the important career change then really came in 65 with the Title VII.
Yes.
the passage of Title
yes.
VII. What happened?
Another fluke. As I said, I was always looking for another job. And I knew this guy, Art Christopher, who liked women. And I used to have lunch with him once in a while, and I think the hook that he would use on my having lunch with him or seeing him, I didn't see him any other way than have lunch with him, but was that he knew people and he could introduce me to people and he'd help me get a job. So one time I had lunch with him, and then I met a friend of mine, Jackie Williams, who is still a friend of mine to this day, I spoke to this morning, and she worked at the NLRB, and she knew this Art Christopher. They are both African American.
Okay.
So I said, oh, I just had lunch with Art Christopher again. He told me he was going to help me find a job, and he's, you know, never comes up really with anything. So she says, oh, you want a job? She says, go across the street. She said, she graduated from Howard Law School, and this guy, Charlie Duncan, I think was dean of Howard Law School at one point. He was certainly her professor, and he had just been named general counsel of the EOC. She says, go across to him. He's hiring people. So I went across the street to, it was across the street from, something like across the street from the Labor Board. I had an interview with this guy, Charlie Duncan.
Mm-hmm.
And I walk in, and he has a desk strewn with papers.
This is in his very earliest days.
I started to work there October 4th, 1965.
That's its earliest days, yeah.
So I'm walking in, and he has a desk with all these papers. And I introduce myself, I'm looking for a job. He says, you see all these papers? I said, yes. He says, those are all applications for jobs. I said, yes. He says, I don't know why, but I'm going to hire you. That's how I got hired.
Wow. And by then, the agency, well, let me think. When did it?
July 2nd, 1965.
Okay. Had you had any, had you been following the Civil Rights Act at all?
Well, I was always interested in rights for African Americans.
Right.
The rest, I don't think so.
But you, and the inclusion of the ban on sex discrimination didn't make an impact on
I didn't know anything about it.
Right away.
I didn't know anything about
okay.
it.
What about the, actually I should probably ask, at this time, were you, did you have a family? Were they living
no.
in Washington? Okay.
I was living in Washington. I was, initially I lived at a hotel for women, which is now part of the Howard campus. It was Meridian Health Hotel for Women. And then I moved to an apartment in Arlington.
Okay.
I did not have, I had my parents and I had my brother, but I did not have a family.
Okay. The reason I ask that is sometimes that influences job decisions. And
no.
Okay, so that's not it. What about the earliest days at the EEOC? Was it chaotic? Where did you fit into this? Did you have a hand in developing the early policy
yes.
guidelines?
Yes.
I guess those are three big questions in
yes.
one. But
well, I started to work at the EOC, whose mandate was to prohibit discrimination based on race, color, religion, sex, and national origin by employers, employment agencies, and labor unions. I came with no personal agenda other than, as I've told you, I was interested in rights for African Americans. There was nothing like rights for women, so I didn't come with that. There was no such thing in this country, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But the only way I can describe this is that there's a Jewish word called chokmas, and I'll try to translate it. It's like tricks, okay? It's not really a good translation. I'll explain what I meant by that. I didn't come with any chokmas. I read the law, and I was naive, and I just read the law, and I thought it should be enforced like it was written.
Okay.
All right? That's all I knew, okay? Well, at DOC at that time, I had 100 people. Most of them were there because they were interested in discrimination against African Americans. So, and you know, sex came in later on, and there's all this, Howard Smith introduced it, and he really wanted to kill the bill and all this and that. So most of the people at the OC were not happy that sex discrimination thing had come in there. Because it was diverting resources and people from what they were there for.
Okay.
I didn't know all this. You know, I just read it and I thought everything has to be handled. So I early on began to be very frustrated there because it was me against everybody else. And who was I?
Were there people who were sympathetic to the labor movement in the EEOC in its early years?
Yeah.
Okay. Did they have any, did they also...
And you've quoted some of them in your paper, Herb Hammerman, Marvin Rogoff.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
Was Catherine, did you meet Catherine Ellickson at all at the EEOC?
Why do I know her name?
She would have been, at that time, an older woman. I don't know how old she would have been, but I thought she was there, and it's very, just for a couple of years, maybe even a year, and it was developing early policy. She was from the CIO, an old labor activist.
No.
But she would, okay. I just was curious if you had crossed paths. It would have
I
been.
Don't think she was there at the beginning, was she?
Well, there's some stuff at the Reuther Archives that she was either that or she was on an intergovernmental agency committee that tried to develop the early guidelines.
I don't
but
know
she
her.
Wasn't there.
No.
Okay. Were you, did you see all the complaints coming in on sex discrimination at this time?
No, because I was in the general counsel's office.
Okay.
We did not deal with individual complaints unless they raised a unique issue.
Okay.
What we were there for was like to help with implementing the law, and we drew up guidelines, and I drafted the first digest of legal interpretations.
Okay.
I don't know that I did the second one. I can't remember. I know I did the first one, which is the, you know, the first one.
Mm-hmm.
So we were really only there to I drafted leading decisions, like the one involving the stewardesses.
Okay.
And other landmark decisions I drafted. And I wrote an important memo on the use of statistics in Title VII cases and so on. I wasn't in doing individual case handling.
Okay. But you were aware that the cases were coming in?
Oh, sure.
Okay. But you wouldn't.
Because the cases raised the issues that we had to deal with.
Right. But I see what you're saying. You weren't in touch with the individual workers in California or Iowa or Chicago who were filing their...
But if they filed a complaint that raised some novel issue, like pregnancy was a big thing, the stewardesses was a big thing in the early days, state protective laws, so the complaints would raise an issue.
I
would be dealing with how should we resolve that issue.
Okay.
Not so much how should we resolve Jane Doe's complaint. Somebody at another level dealt with that, a lower level. But at our level, we were dealing with the issues.
Okay. Was there a sense on your part that you saw the law, it was written, it should have been enforced, it sounds like you're saying.
Yeah.
But was there a sense that the massive numbers of these complaints that were coming across people's desks legitimized or confirmed what you thought, and that is that it was a serious, that it was a problem, that it wasn't, even though it was maybe added in at the last minute to Title VII?
No, I didn't think that. No, I didn't have any views on it at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there was no such views as if I said to you, Dennis, what are your views on whether dogs should be purple? And you would say to me, this I've never given any thought to. I don't have a view on it. Women's rights was like that. There wasn't a purple dog, and there wasn't women's rights. There wasn't such a thing. Nobody thought about it. It didn't exist. So I didn't come in with any views about it.
But once you were there, then something happened.
Well, once I was there, then I would see things like the stewardess cases. I mean, they would, that's a good case because that was an early thing that made me angry. Stewardess cases involve the fact that the airlines terminated women or assigned them to ground duty when they became 32 or 35 or got married. They didn't do it to males. This didn't seem right to me. Okay, it was as simple as that. It didn't seem right to me. Or else they had weightlifting, states had weightlifting limitations.
Mm-hmm.
On women, which were ludicrous. They kept women from getting jobs. Or they had segregated jobs, and women couldn't perform. Women weren't allowed to bid for certain jobs, which it was obvious to me they could do. All right? So I began to talk about those things. My boss, Charlie Duncan, he told me recently he doesn't remember saying this, but he referred to me as a sex maniac. Not in the too commonly used meaning, but because he felt I was obsessed with the sex discrimination provisions of Title VII. Now, this was very burdensome on me, the situation I found myself in at the OC. And I very often used to leave work and the tears would roll down my eyes as I went to my car, because I was in this difficult position of being basically alone with this idea that they should do something about sex discrimination. I was a low-level employee, you know, I don't know what the hell I was there, a grade 9 or a grade 11 or a 12 or 13, I don't know, I was a low-level employee, although I was the first woman in the general counsel's office, but I was not any kind of big shot. I was fighting this battle for sex discrimination. Nobody had elected me to it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know how I found myself in this position. Now, there were other people sympathetic to it. Eileen Hernandez, one of the first commissioners, and Dick Graham, one of the first commissioners. Sam Jackson, one of the first commissioners, was kind of on the fence. He was really there to do for African Americans, but he was reasonable on the issue of women's rights. I was fortunate that my boss, Charlie Duncan, an African American, was educable, and I educated him, and he took it, all right? Now, some people did. Then there were other people, though, that were really opposed, and one was Herman Adelsberg,
mm-hmm.
And it bothered me that two of the people most opposed were Jews,
mm-hmm.
Jewish men.
Mm-hmm.
Herman Adelsberg was one, and Dick Berg was another one, and Dick Berg was deputy general counsel. And they were totally opposed to doing something about sex discrimination. And they all these people that were opposed were in higher positions than I was. And yet there I was fighting this battle, you know. So it was a very painful experience.
But there were a few allies. What about Win Newman at this time? Is he with the...
I don't think he was there.
Okay.
He came later then.
Were there any allies that you started sensing were... outside the EEOC?
Yes, that's what happened.
Okay. All right.
Somehow, and I can tell you, we don't know how this happened, I began to be in touch with other women at other federal agencies who were like me. And we began to have a little network of sharing information. One was a woman named Mary Eastwood, who was in the Department of Justice, and who with Dr. Paulie Murray, whom I was just talking, who's the one that, the woman, the professor from Iowa wrote, I wrote to her.
Linda Kerber.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
She wrote an op-ed piece about Paulie Murray, which made me
right.
answer her.
Right. Okay.
All right.
Okay.
So, Mary Eastwood was the co-author with Paulie Murray of the first Law Review article on Title VII called Jane Crow and the Law.
Okay, right.
I have it in my basement library. And so Mary Eastwood was one. Another one was Catherine East.
I met her yesterday.
Tremendous contribution that she made. Catherine, I don't know whether she was in the Women's Bureau at that time or where she was at the time. Department of Labor, maybe. Catherine East. A little bit later, Dr. Bernice Sandler, I had dinner with her last night. This is just to show you that we are all together still.
Right, that is amazing.
Mary, I had dinner with 2 weeks ago. She lives in Wisconsin. Bunny, I had dinner with last night. Catherine, I see all the time. Bunny came along a little bit later, and she wasn't working in the government, but she was interested in sex discrimination and education. And she is, to this day, the leading authority in the United States, as far as I'm concerned, on discrimination against women and students in colleges and universities, and also sexual harassment and campus violence.
What is her name again?
Dr. Bernice Sandler.
Okay.
And another one came a little bit later, was Tina, Tina Hobson.
Okay.
Who is, she had another name at that time. She's the widow of Julius Hobson, a very famous man here, an African-American. Tina's white, an African-American man who fought discrimination here, and was very well known.
Let me quickly turn the tape over so we don't miss any of this.